you're interested in what I will cover, I will definitely cover in this course canonical models, and I hope to have a couple of lectures on points mod P, but that will be everything. I won't be able to cover as much as I hoped. So, in order to understand Shamor varieties, one has to understand fully one good example, so you know what can happen in the good cases, and one should also understand one very bad example, so you know what can go wrong. So today, we'll look at the good example. But before I start, I should write down a dictionary of things which we'll use a lot. So, we've used it already, but we want to use it some more. So V is an R vector space. Then there are different ways of describing the same object. So the first thing, object, is simply a J such that J squared is equal to minus 1. Well, of course, that defines a complex structure on C. So from that, we get a map from here into in RV just by setting, well, taking J to I equal J. And of course, from this, we get a map from, let's call it H, from C cross into GLV invertible maps from V into itself. And from this, we get so far, of course, this is nothing. But down here we get I claim that this is, to give one of these is the same as to give a Hodge structure of type V10 or 10 and 01. And the way you get this one is you take V10, so you have to write VC as V10 plus V01. Decompose this, and you decompose this so that, well, in this term here, Z acts as Z bar on here and acts as Z on here. So this is H of Z. Or, so according to this, H of I is equal to J. So J equals JX is minus I here and plus I here. So to give any one of these four objects is to give all four. And the reason I write down all four is that we should be thinking of the Hodge structures all the time. But of course, it's a lot more convenient. It's kind of clumsy to think of a Hodge structure of type 1001. Much easier to think of a vector space plus a J. So I'll be using this dictionary between these four different types of objects all the time. And also, if we have a skew symmetric form, then the conditions we're interested in here that keeps turning up all the time is, one is that it's invariant on J. If you look here or here, say, then if you use this condition and you take and you look at psi of A plus I B U, A plus I B V, then of course psi is R bilinear. So I mean R bilinear. So we can expand that out and you get one term where you get from here and here, you get the U and the V with the A squared coming out, and then you get one term from here. Yeah, and the point is that, remember, you can take the I's out. So we're assuming this condition here. What happens when we do this? So if you're assuming this condition, it means that you can take an I out of here in both cases. So we get a term A squared plus B squared, and you can also check that the cross terms cancel. So this condition here is equivalent to, this is the absolute value of Z squared phi UV. Another condition is that we want to consider often is this condition plus the condition that if you put psi J UV equal to psi U JV, then this is positive definite, symmetric positive definite. And in these terms here, I defined maybe the second lecture, the notion of a polarization of a Hodge structure. And it's not quite the definition, but if you have a bilinear skew symmetric form with these two conditions, that is equivalent to having a saying it's a polarization down here. Okay, so to give a J is the same as to give a Hodge structure of this type. And to give a, if you have an R bilinear skew symmetric form up here, then to satisfy these conditions, it's the same as just to say it's a polarization for the Hodge structure. Okay, so I'll write that down. So we use this dictionary a lot. So now I want to do a little bit of linear algebra. So we have vector space V over, since it's linear algebra, it's over any field characteristic not equal to 2. And I want a non-degenerate skew symmetric form. Then, well, I'll call a symplectic basis. So let's say this has dimension 2g. I call a symplectic basis for the form a basis such that, well, I write it in this, it turns out it's much easier if you write bases with plus, negative, and positive indices. So psi of eg e minus g is equal to plus 1, and psi of e of minus g eg is equal to minus 1. And all the other one, excuse me, should be I. And then all the other ones are 0. And probably I hope everyone's seen the theorem that, in fact, symplectic bases exist. If you have a non-degenerate skew symmetric form, you can always find a basis so that the elements pair off and you pair these two, you get plus 1, and this way around they get minus 1, and all the other ones are 0. So symplectic bases exist. So given that, we can define the group of symplectic similitudes. So they're the automorphisms of V that preserve the skew symmetric form up to a non-zero constant. So in other words, this is equal to the set of G belong to the automorphism such that there exists a C such that psi G U G V is equal to C psi U V for all U and V. So the C depends on the G, but it doesn't depend on the U and the V. So we can write it as mu of G. And then we define the symplectic group by the following exact sequence. So it's the things that actually preserve the form exactly, not just up to a scalar. So this is new. I'm writing this new using the same. Well, in the picture I had up here, this is the reductive group. This is the derived group. This is a simply connected, semi-simple group. And this is what I was writing T yesterday. What else do I need? Well, the center of this is a GM again. So the scalar matrices are contained in here. And this map across here is just the square again. So it looks a lot like the picture we had for GL2. And in fact, if you take V to have dimension 2, this is just GL2. The point is that if you have a vector space of dimension 2, there's only up to scalars, there's only one non-degenerate skew symmetric form, and therefore it's preserved up to scalars by every automorphism. So you get just GL2. So this is a direct generalization of GL2 and SL2 and so on. So yeah, there's just one observation I want to make, and that is that I claim that that SP, the symplectic group, acts simply transitively on the symplectic bases. So if I take just take two bases, never mind the symplectic for the moment, then everybody knows there's a unique automorphism of V that takes this to this, takes corresponding elements to corresponding elements. And you simply check that, well, it's in fact obvious, that if both bases, so there does exist a unique G belong to GL, V carrying corresponding basis elements to corresponding basis elements. And of course, it's completely obvious that if these are both symplectic bases, this preserves the form, preserves it on a basis, and therefore preserves it everywhere. So if these are symplectic bases, then okay. So that's all the linear algebra we need, I think. So now I can find the Shimura variety. So now I fix V and a psi, and this is now, I take it to be over Q. And So a complex structure on VR. So this is a Q vector space. VR, I just mean V tensor R. So I'll call this positive relative to psi if satisfies the two conditions up there, namely psi of JU, JV is equal to psi of UV. And psi of j is symmetric positive definite. So I'm fixing the psi, and I'm looking at all the complex structures on V to satisfy this condition. And we'll see in a moment they do exist. And I'll say it's negative S. Same condition here, but psi of J is negative definite. Psi of J, I mean the form up here. And I let X plus denote all those, and X minus denote all those, and I let X equal X plus. Disjoint union X minus. So, see, in a second, there do exist positive ones, and there do exist negative ones, and of course, most of the complex structures will be neither positive nor negative, and they won't, so they won't be an X. Now, how do I know they exist? Well, if I write down a symplectic basis for psi, so this is a symplectic basis. And I can define a positive J by writing down, I send EI to E minus I, and I send E minus I, so I'm defining the J. It sends E minus I to minus EI. Well, I claim that if I do that, then this is automatically a positive. Well, first of all, square is minus one. If I do it twice, I multiply every basis vector with minus one. So it is a complex structure, and I claim it's positive. We should check at least something. So let's check that. Suppose I take EI, J of EI. Let's suppose that I is positive. So that will just take J, this one will just take this to be, this is psi. Yeah. Psi of EI, yeah, so psi of J of EI, EI is equal to this. We should check this as positive, at least. And it is, because if I is positive, so take it to minus I, and according to this comes out as plus 1. On the other hand, if I is negative, so let's look at E minus I, J, E minus I, then in this case, it'll take it to minus E I down here. And you can, well, without the minus sign, there's a minus, so two minus signs come out, so it's plus. And, you can check the other conditions, but I guess they're pretty obvious. But, so, given a symplectic basis, you can get a positive J, so they certainly exist. And all of them come in this way, so I'll let you check this if you like. So, conversely, given a J, the J I define in this fashion belongs to X plus. Conversely, given a J in X plus, then I claim that J takes this form. For relative to an orthonormal basis. Basis for psi of J. So if J is positive, then psi of J is a positive definite symmetric form, so you have an orthonormal basis. An orthonormal basis will actually be a symplectic basis for So an orthonormal basis for psi of j will be a symplectic basis for psi, and j will take this form here relative to this will be a symplectic basis. And it takes this form. So we see we get a surjective map from symplectic bases to X plus. Now, I want to abbreviate things. I want now to write G for GSP, psi, and S for SP, psi. It's a clumsy notation. So there's an action of this is symplectic bases. This is symplectic bases over R. There's an action of SR on symplectic bases, obviously. And there's an action of SR on here where you say, take, if you have something in here, you say G, this is equal to G, JG inverse. So I claim that it's pretty obvious, that this map from here to here is equivariant if you let SR act in the obvious way on a symplectic basis and it act by conjugation on complex structures on V. So since SR acts simply transitively on here, we see that SR acts transitively on here. So we conclude SR acts transitively on. You can even work out what the stabilizer of a complex structure, what one of the J's is, because it's anyway, this is the key point, is that when we let SR act on complex structures, on the J's, by conjugation like this, it acts transitively. And with only a slight more effort, you see that the GR, if you let it act by conjugation, acts transitively on the both of them. I think if you take G belong to GR, if you choose a symplectic basis and you look at the element in here which sends EI to EI, that's obviously stupid. What I want is E plus minus I goes to E minus or plus I. So it sends E plus I to E minus I. So and this matrix looks like this. Then I think if you check, then mu of g is minus 1, and this sends positive j's to negative j's. And this is what happened. So this is the picture. So now, according to my dictionary over there, I can think of the x's as being, in an obvious fashion, I can think of them as being homomorphisms from C cross into GLRV. So given a J belonging to x, I get an HJ, which is a C cross into GLV. V, right. And because it has this property up here, it has that property on the third row there, and that tells me that in fact Hj actually lies in G of R. So this would be R. So you can see even more. I mean, so because we're assuming J has this property here, then the corresponding H. So J itself lies in this symplectic group, and H of Z will lie in the group of symplectic similitudes. Now, this correspondence here is completely one-to-one, so we have J going backwards and forward, Hj, and we have an action of things in here on the J's, and that corresponds. So out of this, we've managed to construct a reductive group. So a lot of this is just, we've been working over R, but in fact, I really did start with something over Q. So my reductive group actually is a reductive group over Q. And I've defined, I've written down quite explicitly a conjugacy class of homomorphisms from C cross into the real points of my reductive group over Q. And now I want to check that it satisfies the axioms to define a Shimura variety. So this is a Shimura datum. And yeah, before I do that, maybe I said, those of you who are used to thinking of Ziegler half planes and Ziegler modular groups in terms of matrices, you can, if you choose a symplectic basis, then somehow, if you choose a symplectic basis, then you do get the symplectic group, obviously, written in terms of 2x2 blocks, matrix blocks. And with a bit of effort, you can see that the X plus is the Ziegler upper half plane, but it's not completely obvious, except in the case of G equal 1, but it's true. But this is a much more illuminating way of thinking of the Ziegler upper half space. Yeah, I should say, this whole situation is looking at the Ziegler. Essentially, this is a Ziegler modular variety, and the X plus is a Ziegler upper half space. So we want to check the axioms. So what do the axioms say? The first one says that at H of Z, if you look at it, it acts on the algebra of GC through the characters, only the characters Z over Z bar 1 and Z bar over 1, Z. Now, what's the Lie algebra of G? It's very easy to work out, but I think it's a set of things. So you think of it as a sub-Lie algebra. G is a subgroup of the general linear group of V, so the Lie algebra of the general linear group of V is just the endomorphisms of V, so this must just be some sub the algebra of the endomorphisms of V. So this is a set of things. Such that psi of GU right. Oh. No. Anyway, sitting inside ENV, that's what we care about. Ah, right. So let me see. Now we have our V. Yeah, we have our HJ. And we're in exactly in the situation here. We started with a J like that, and we get an H like this, and we get a Hodge structure of type, this type down here. So what this means is that we take our vector space. It decomposes into this plus space. This is the 1, 0, and the minus. Minus plus. And HJ is Z, acts as Z bar here and Z here. So yeah, we don't want to. So we want to see how we want to see how HJZ acts on this thing with the, when you tensor with a complex number. So on VC it acts in this fashion. VC decomposes into two bits, a V minus and a V plus, and here it acts as Z minus and here it acts as Z. Now if I have an automorphism of a complex vector space, so suppose I have an automorphism of complex vector space and I have an endomorphism of the vector space. So how do you make alpha act on F? Well, the only sensible way is you make it act in this fashion, alpha F alpha inverse V, okay? So if you have an automorphism of the vector space and you have an endomorphism of the vector space, then how do the automorphism of the vector space act on the endomorphisms of the vector space? By this rule here. This is the only choice. Well, if you want a left action. Okay, so if you look at end VC, this decomposes as end V plus HOM V minus into V plus and plus HOM of V plus into V minus plus end V minus. Now, H of Z acts as Z bar here and a Z plus just Z itself here. So on homomorphisms from here to here, it acts as, well, you get an inverse from there and a Z from here. So it acts on as Z over Z bar. Okay. So if you just take an automorphism, a V which acts as Z on here and Z bar on here, then on homomorphisms from one to the other, it acts as the quotient here. So on here, it acts as Z bar over Z, and here it acts as Z over Z, which is 1, and here it acts as Z bar over Z bar, which is 1. So even on the bigger space, you see that this is just linear algebra. You just add H of Z, knowing that H of Z acts in this fashion here, then on the endomorphism algebra it acts through these characters, and therefore on the subalgebra it can only act through those characters as well. So we get that the axiom SB1 is true. SB2 So something is a cut on involution. Well, the condition says it's a cut on involution on the adjoint group, but I'll prove something a little better. I'll prove it's a cut on involution on the derived group. Well, it's the same, actually. But so remember, cut on involution of a group meant that if you looked at, so if you have a group G over R, H over R, and you had an involution of the group, then the map, the things, so the set of G belong to H C such that when you conjugate in the natural fashion, then apply theta, the things that are fixed, this is compact. That's the definition of a cut on involution. It's an involution of the group over R. So when you look at the things of the complex numbers satisfying this equation, you get a compact subgroup. Now, if you do this, if you look, so you want to see the theta equal to conjugation by HJI, where J is either positive or negative. Well, yeah. So we want to see that that's a cut on involution, and the axiom says it's a cut on involution on the adjoint group, but we can check that it's actually a cut on involution on S on the symplectic group. So I claim, this is worked out in the early part of the notes, that in this case, with theta equal to this, this comes down to the set of G belong to the So the calculation is done in notes in some, maybe the first lecture where I talked about the view of real groups or something like that. When you work it out in this case, then you find that this group here is in this case for this equal to this and theta equal to this, what you get is in fact the set of G belong to GLV, meaning over R, that preserve the okay. It's an easy calculation to do this, see that. I mean the J goes in there, and so it's not the thing that fix psi, but sort of fix psi once you conjugate them with J. Now, by definition, if J is an X plus, this is the psi of J is a positive definite symmetric form. And the way to get compact groups is you look at the things fixing a positive symmetric form. In terms of bases, they just give you the orthogonal, real orthogonal matrices, which is certainly a compact group. Okay. Yeah. Maybe we do get the unit. Maybe I'm cheating. Anyway, one way. Yeah, maybe it's more natural unitary. Yeah. Yeah, I think you're right. But you get the unitary group with respect to the Hermitian form, which is associated with this thing. Yeah. Right. Anyway, it's written out in the notes in detail. Right. So there's I mean, the point I want to make is that this is somehow relatively easy to check these axioms. And then once you have the axioms, then you have everything else. You have emission symmetric domains, you have the whole Shamor variety. So the axioms are quite pleasant, and there's sort of a minimal set of things you have to check, and then you get everything else. And the third axiom was, remember, this was just some dumb condition that I put on so that I didn't get any Q factors of the adjoint group, which were compact over the real numbers, but in this case, this group is actually a simple group. It doesn't have any Q factors. I mean, it has a center, but it's simple. So this is trivial. Well, so we have the so we have a Shamor variety. And of course, if you take dimension 2, then you just get the GL2 and so on. And maybe I tell you how you've why. In the case of GL2, you send J to the, so it's a V plus, which is a line in NP. So in this case, you get X is identified just by sending, in the case of GL2, you send a complex structure to the V plus corresponding with a, so you get a map and I think we discussed this sort of thing before. So X becomes identified with a complex projective line minus the real projective line, which is the same as the up and lower complex plane. This is just we send a J and X to the line V plus in VC. So this is when V is two-dimensional, this works very easily. If you want an exercise, then you can, for those of you who know what the Zeigler upper half plane and lower half plane, you can check that X can be identified canonically with them in general. Okay, so this is the Shamor variety, so now we can apply what I proved last time very simply, and things that we'll discuss later. But there's one thing that should be lacking. I mean, I don't have enough. So I have the description of the point of some double coset. You know, in the case where V has dimension 2, then you have the modular curve, so the points correspond in a natural way with elliptic curves. So it would be very nice if we could describe the points on a Shamor variety. Well, they can't be elliptic curves, they must be abelian varieties. So we can do that, and we can do it quite easily, but we first of all have to review abelian varieties. So I've set everything up, so we'll see quite quickly once we review some stuff on abelian varieties that there's a nice correspondence between the points on the Shamor variety corresponding to the Shamor datum and the abelian varieties. So I'll start. I don't want to raise this. So I'll start talking a little bit about abelian varieties of the complex numbers. In case someone hasn't seen the definition, so an abelian variety is just over any field is just a projective variety plus a group structure. And it's a group structure as an algebraic variety, so the maps are regular. And these imply that the group structure is abelian, is commutative. know, as people say, the beginning with a big A implies a beginning with a small a. So what we want to do is, fortunately, there's a theorem of Riemann that tells us that if you look at the beginning varieties over the complex numbers, they have a nice linear algebra description, which is very similar to the description of elliptic curves, it's just C modulo lattice. But before we do that, well, that's what I want to explain. So, if we have C to the G, then by a lattice in here, I mean a full lattice, and by that I mean Z module generated by a real basis for this. So I mean a Z module such that it's sitting inside there such that when you tensor lambda with R, then you get C to the G. Then C to the G modulo lambda, this has a natural structure as a complex manifold, and this quotient has a natural structure as a complex manifold. And so I'll call this a complex torus with this structure. Now, the first thing one needs, so at the moment we're just dealing with complex manifolds. The first thing one needs is that, suppose we have two of them. So we have, yeah, I should say there's a confusion in the notation, a complex torus and the notion of a torus in algebraic groups, and they don't quite coincide. Never mind. So this is what I mean by a complex torus. So just a complex manifold, C to the G modulo a lattice. So in the case G equal 1, of course, this is something you're familiar with, I hope. Now, if we have two of these things, then if I have a C linear map, such that then we get, so from such a thing, we get a map of complex manifolds like this. And the observation is that all maps of complex manifolds, so every map of complex manifolds, well, you have to remember a condition, so 0 goes to 0. So I claim that every map of complex manifolds like this, sending 0 to 0, in fact, comes in this way from a linear map across here, sending this into this. Every map of complex holomorphic map arises in this way. You've probably seen this in the case G and G prime equal to 1. No? Yes? Well, I'll leave it to the notes anyway. It's easy. I mean, the point is, if you have a map like this, and this is the universal covering space of this, and this is the universal covering space of this. So it lists to the universal covering space, so you do get a map. The only problem is seeing that it actually has to be a linear map up here. So I'll leave it to the notes. So what this says is that complex manifolds, it's very easy. To start understanding complex manifolds, just on linear algebra. You just have to look at, so they're all given by this with a lattice, by definition, and to give a map from one to the other, you just have to give a C-linear map which satisfies the obvious condition. So complex manifolds are linear algebra. Yeah, right. So this is true for abelian varieties as well. Any map of abelian varieties which takes 0 to 0 is actually a homomorphism in the group. Yeah, you're right. I mean, it's a curious observation. So if we have a complex manifold, so far we don't have any algebraic structures. Then if we look at this, then this is in fact the universal covering space. This is simply connected, and it's a covering map, and that all one needs to be a universal covering space. And the covering transformations are just lambda. So we see that pi 1 of M it has a canonical point of 0 is equal to lambda. And so for any topological manifold, certainly, its first cohomology group is just hom pi 1 m 0 z. So this is just, in our case, it's just hom lambda into z. And I claim one can do a lot better. So if you have a complex torus, then you have that, and I claim HNM canonically isomorphic, so somehow you jack this up, so into homomorphism from lambda to the n. Exterior out-sphere product of lambda. So, and more down to earth terms, that what I have here is it's alternating multilinear forms from lambda to z. Okay, and down to earth terms, I'm claiming that's a nth cohomology group of a complex torus is canonically isomorphic to the set of alternating forms on lambda, n-fold alternating forms on lambda. So it's a generalization of this. Here's the linear forms, and this is so. So the proof, I'll just give the key point, put a little more on the notes perhaps. The key point is to show that, well, I ignore the linear algebra. So the key point is to show that if you have a complex torus, then cup product gives you a map from here to here. And we have to see that this is an isomorphism. Once you see that, then it's just getting from here to here is just linear algebra. So let C be the class of topological manifolds such that this holds for all C, for M. Then, what do we know about C? Well, I claim that the circle lies in C as this property. Because the cohomology groups of the circle are just Z, Z, and zeros from then on. So this is cup product. It's important that it's given by cup product. So second thing we observe is that if you have two manifolds, topological manifolds, M1 and M2 belong to C, then that implies that their product belongs to C. And this is just the Kunneth formula. Well, the Kunneth formula vaguely expressed tells you what the cohomology of the product of two. The topological spaces is in terms of the cohomology of each one. So it ought to tell us this. And then we're done, because if you look at C to the G over lambda, it's just topologically is isomorphic to S1 to the 2G. It's a topological manifold. It's just a product of circles. Okay. This is a circle. Real circle. Okay. Now we come to the big theorem. So if I have suppose you have a complex torus, and I'll call a polarization for M. Well, let's see, I'll use the right term. It's a Riemann form. For M, so it's appearing lambda cross lambda to Z, so it's skew symmetric. And now, when we look at lambda tends to R, by definition, this is CG. So this comes with a J. This real, a priori real vector space is actually a complex vector space, so it comes with a J. And the remaining conditions I still have written up there. So the remaining conditions is that psi R, when you look at it over there, it satisfies those two conditions there. Not, no surprise that these conditions keep turning up all the time. I mean, okay. I really mean that whole thing up there. So Riemann form for complex torus is simply appearing like, so it's just exactly that up there, except it starts off over Z. And then Riemann theorem is that the theorem they won't prove, and that is that says that M is equal to, so we take a complex torus, and the theorem says that this is projective. So you can embed it as a closed complex manifold of projective space if and only if there exists a Riemann form. And then Chow's theorem, of course, tells us that it's actually a projective algebraic variety. Remember, projective complex manifolds and projective algebraic varieties are the same thing. is a category equivalence. So proof, you can find in Mumford's book on algebraic varieties, or you can find it in Kumamoto's book on introduction to algebraic varieties. The proof, of course, is given the Riemann form, you somehow have to construct a lot of functions, enough functions to embed it into projective space. So the upshot, so by Chow, this means it's actually a projective algebraic variety. So it's actually an abelian variety, because it acquires a group structure from the complex group structure. So the upshot of all this is that, in fact, I guess there's another argument to show that, a small argument, to show that all abelian varieties arise in this fashion. So it's just a small argument that an abelian variety, if you think of it as a complex manifold, it really is a complex torus, which is very easy to prove. So the upshot of what I've been saying is that, first of all, that complex tori, studying complex tori, is just linear algebra. You just have to give a lattice in here, then once you have the lattices, then everything, the maps between them are just described by linear algebra. And then the Riemann theorem tells us that complex, that abelian varieties are really the same thing as complex tori. So studying abelian varieties is really just linear algebra. This is really a beautiful and amazing result, and it's going to have really important consequences for us in theory of Shamor varieties.